Good afternoon and welcome to Open Air, KLW's weekly magazine of most things culturally considered. I'm your host, David LaTulipe. This week, conversations with Michael Urie about his one-man show at the Curran, Buyer and Seller, with a C-E-L-L-A-R, which takes us into Barbra Streisand's basement. With Helene Whitson, who is the co-founder of the San Francisco Lyric Chorus, who shares details about their upcoming concert. And a healthy helping of choral music this week, conductor Bob Geary joins us, who leads the San Francisco Choral Society and music of Brahms this weekend. Plus, critic at large, Peter Robinson returns with a review of the movie Calvary and the Cal Shakes production of Pygmalion and offers a tribute to Lauren Bacall. Stay tuned. Well, it's a terrific weekend for choral music right here in San Francisco, with both the San Francisco Lyric Chorus and San Francisco Choral Society presenting major concerts both Saturday and Sunday, which works out well for you, dear listener, because then you can catch one on Saturday and the other on Sunday. We'll hear later this hour from Helene Whitson, president and co-founder of the San Francisco Lyric Chorus, which, under the direction of Robert Gurney, will be performing the Durufle Requiem and the Josef Jungen Mass at Mission Dolores Basilica this weekend. And my first guest, conductor Bob Geary, leading his charges, the San Francisco Choral Society and the Brahms Requiem and choral work Nanya, with soloists Eugene Brancovianu and Marnie Breckenridge. Bob's been my guest here before on Open Air, and when he's not looking for the perfect wave to ride, he's leading the San Francisco Choral Society in its 25th anniversary season. Or he's leading Volti, the chamber chorus he founded. Or you might see him conducting the Piedmont Boys and Girls Choirs. He's also director of the Golden Gate International Children's Choral Festival. A champion of and highly lauded conductor of contemporary music, he returns to Brahms for this weekend's concert. Bob, welcome back to our Waves of Air.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Now, you're returning to the Brahms Requiem for this weekend, having performed it with the chorus in 91, in 95, I believe in 2001 and 2007, and now back in 2014. Is this your bohème or butterfly in terms of box office bang?
A good question. I'm not sure about box office bang. It definitely is a piece that has a following. I actually find, I can't wait to get back to it every 5, 6, 7 years. It's one of those pieces that has such a deep resonance, and it's such a joy to work on. It's very satisfying for the singers to sing. It's very emotionally fulfilling to go through the process of preparing and performing the piece. And it is, I think, one of the more cathartic pieces to listen to and to perform.
Well, this work dates from the 1860s. It's really the defining work of Brahms, and turned out to be his longest work as well.
Yeah, his longest work. I mean, I think there's arguments for symphonies and concertos on the instrumental side, but as one of the, it has to be in the, you know, the top 10 of greatest choral works ever composed. And it's unique in its approach, and it was kind of revolutionary in its approach, too, because he calls it a requiem. It's called a German requiem, but in fact is a completely abandons the text that actually is the requiem text, which is the Roman Catholic Requiem Mass, and Brahms went an entirely different route.
Well, later this hour, we'll learn about the choral performances of Jungen's Mass, which was written almost as a celebration of Jungen's learning that his son had been liberated from a Nazi prison camp, very different in style, and then yet written within a year of the Jungen, the Durufle Requiem, which was written for as a memorial to the composer's father, and now this Brahms German Requiem. What makes it titled as such a German ein deutsches Requiem?
Yeah. Well, I mean, remember where the Reformation started. And Brahms, who, you know, was grew up humble beginnings, he played a lot of barroom piano, was a reader, and he read the Bible regularly himself. Quite a few scholars think that he actually was not a believer, but he was a student of you know, literature and lessons, let's say. So he assembled from the Bible a whole bunch of texts that never mention God and never mention Jesus. They're Old Testament and some New Testament, but they...
And was criticized for it after the fact as
yeah.
well.
Yeah, I mean, it was definitely a departure from the traditional and historical grip of creating music for memorializing or helping us to experience loss.
Tell us about your personal relationship with this work, then.
Hmm. I think my first performance of it was when I was working with the wonderful First Unitarian Universalist Church Choir in San Francisco a long time ago.
Which you led for a number of years.
Yeah, I did. I was very happily ensconced there. It's a wonderful place. I think that's where my study... I had sung it as a student back east, but that was the first time I conducted it. And it was one of those pieces that once you conduct it the first time, you realize how much more there is to mine or to reveal or bring forward. So now, with a few performances behind me, I really feel like it's part of who I am to conduct that piece. You know, I've got it so internalized, and I so appreciate it.
So we mentioned that you're coming back to this piece. What kind of new tidbits have you discovered in the piece?
Or does it vary from
year to year, depending on the chorus you're
working
with?
No, I would say there some of the way the text is orchestrated, the way the choir sings with the orchestra is new. There are moments of... last night in our dress rehearsal in Davies Hall, I stopped the choir and I said, "You're filled with fear, and this is the most angst driven." And then they sang it again, and they sang it too beautifully. And I said, "No, that was great. It was beautiful, but it's not the point here. We are the people who are confronting our own personal fears around these issues of life, death, loss." So I think it's maybe to just find a little bit more of the immediacy, the contemporary expression. It's not like we're reading old poetry. It's like we are experiencing the process of that the Requiem brings forward.
Well, let's talk about that process and the arc of the piece. We mentioned that it doesn't follow the Latin Mass for the dead or the Latin Mass.
Yeah, there's not one word Latin Mass.
So how does this great work unfold?
Yeah, he sets it up. It's kind of a palindrome, meaning it's a little bit of a mirror if you start in the middle movement and look outward emotionally. So it's seven movements, and the middle movement, I think we're going to hear a little bit later, movement number four. It starts off, blessed are the living, blessed are those who are here who have suffered the loss. And then it kind of goes a little bit deeper in the second movement into a sense of the devastation. Third movement, the baritone solo, says, "Lord, teach us to understand that we all have an end." And then fourth movement kind of releases into this beautiful, comforting idea that this world we're in is a beautiful world, and whether we call it God's world or the world, it's beautiful. And then the fifth movement, the soprano soloist, and this was the movement that was added a few years after. It was originally a six-movement work. But the soprano soloist sort of creates hope and is very comforting. I mean, it's a perfectly cast moment for a woman's voice to bring, and it's such an exquisitely, melodically beautiful part. And I have to say, Marnie Breckenridge is singing the lights out of it. So that kind of gives us hope. And then finally, in the last movement, there's this very cathartic moment where we say, okay, it's all good, and blessed are the dead. They've found peace, and we're all here, and we have united around this process and come out the other side of it, and we've got love in our heart and all of that. It's just very special.
Well, let's hear a little bit of that ending, and then we'll have more with
sure.
Robert Gary. Tell us what we're going to hear in this.
This is the seventh movement, and it starts off with sopranos, and they sing Blessed Are the Dead. Remember, it starts off, the first words are blessed are the living, or blessed are those who suffer, but those who remain here.
Here we'll hear Claudio Abbado in the Berlin Philharmonic and Chorus. just a touch of that final movement of the Brahms Requiem. We heard Claudio Abbado and the Berlin Philharmonic and the Swedish Radio Chorus in that brief excerpt. You can hear the full San Francisco Choral Society under the direction of Bob Geary, 210 or so voices, full orchestra in Davie Symphony Hall this Saturday at 8 and Sunday at 4. That really is some incredible
Friday and Saturday, 8 o'clock both nights.
All right, that's okay, great. Well, Friday and Saturday at 8, there we go. And that's at Davies Hall, information at sfchoral.org. That's some, it's just some amazing music. You've also got Nanya on the work.
Yes.
Another amazing, one of the first Brahms I've ever sung when I was in college.
Yeah, you mentioned that. Yeah, I'm so glad to know you were part of the Ithaca music program. They had such good music training back in the New
Germany.
York system there. Nanya was, you know, is in memoriam to a painter who died, who apparently was a beautiful man, or at the very least a beautiful painter. I've never seen a picture of him. But the Schiller composed an ode to him that's just real rich in Greek mythological referencing. So it's one of those really classical texts that as I say, is also a memorial. That kind of the punchline is that even the beautiful die, gorgeously orchestrated, it'll be the short first movement on the program, about 16 minutes, and then off we go with the Requiem.
So our other choral guests on today's program, San Francisco Lyric Chorus, is celebrating 20 years next season. This is 25 for the San Francisco Choral Society. What else is planned for the season then? We're starting off with a bang.
Well, thank you for asking. We're starting a very interesting project. In November, we've commissioned a new oratorio from Stacey Garup, who's a wonderful composer. She teaches at Roosevelt in Chicago, but she actually grew up in the East Bay area, just having a great career as a young composer with lots of good commissions. So we've asked her to write an oratorio that we'll bring out in three movements, one in November, one in April, and then all three a year from November. And each of those movements will be paired with something else on the program because they'll be a shorter part of it. So in November, we'll perform Vaughan Williams' Dona Nobis Pacem, which is mostly poetry of Walt Whitman and a really powerful piece, reflection on difficulties of war. And in the spring, we'll pair the second movement of that new oratorio with Handel's Dixit Dominus, which after Messiah is really his other choral brilliant masterpiece, in my view. I mean, he wrote great oratorios too, but it's predominantly choral work. And then next summer, it's been many years since we did a Mozart Requiem, so we've got a Mozart Requiem coming out. And then, the following November will conclude that year. And
Our radio audiences don't have that long.
Yeah. I could go on, yeah.
We'll have you back for that. How about that?
Fair enough.
Robert Geary leading Brahms with the San Francisco Choral Society Friday and Saturday at 8 at Davie Symphony Hall. Information at sfchoral.org. Soloists Eugene Brancovianu, who I had here as a guest as well, and Marnie Breckenridge, full orchestra at Davie Symphony Hall. I should mention that the Choral Society provides Bay Area high school students with the opportunity to participate in rehearsals and performances at no cost to them. So check out their website for more information on that, sfchoral.org. Bob, thanks again for coming in today.
Hey, it's a pleasure. Thank you, David.
And we're going to go out with a little bit more of the Brahms Requiem. This text taken from Psalm 84, How Lovely Is Thy Dwelling Place, from Ein Deutsches Requiem of Johannes Brahms. Deutsches Requiem of Johannes Brahms, once again, Friday and Saturday at Davies Symphony Hall, the San Francisco Choral Society. Good afternoon. I'm David LaTulipe. Still to come, more choral music with the San Francisco Lyric Chorus. Peter Robinson will also be by to talk about a Lauren Bacall remembrance, as well as a movie and some Cal Shakes review. And I guess we could call this next segment From the Sublime to the Fairly Ridiculous with my guest, Michael Urey. Michael might be best known to TV fans for his portrayal of Mark St. James on the ABC dramedy series Ugly Betty, for which he earned an Emmy nomination for Best Supporting Actor in a Comedy Series in 2009.
Did I?
I thought so.
No, I didn't.
Oh, it's misinformation. Would you like one?
I would have loved that.
We could get something made up.
I was nominated for 3 Teen Choice Awards.
Oh, well, that counts.
It's about, those three added together is about like one Emmy nomination, I think.
And instead of a Golden Globe, it was a plastic orb or something.
Something like that. I think it was a surfboard, actually. I think you got a surfboard if you win. I didn't win. Thank you, Steve Carell. But I think a surfboard would have been what I got.
A native of Dallas, Texas. He's a Juilliard-trained actor. Did I get that right?
That's right.
All right. And I think you did win the 2002 John Houseman Prize for Excellence in Classical Theater.
Yes, I did. That is true.
All right. Something correct there. Your New York theater credits include How to Succeed in Business Without Really Trying, on Broadway, playing Bud Frump to Nick Jonas's J. Pierpont Finch. Also in The Cherry Orchard, Angels in America, The Temperamentals, and another Vermeer. For originating the role of Alex Moore in Jonathan Tollin's Buyer and Seller at Rattlestick Playwrights Theater and its Barrow Street Theater Transfer, Michael received a number of awards, including the Drama Desk Award and nominations for the Drama League and Outer Critics Circle Awards, if I'm not mistaken on that.
Yeah, you're right.
And the off-Broadway production of Buyer and Seller recently closed after more than a year of performances in New York. Subsequent productions in L.A., and as of Tuesday and through the end of the month, here in San Francisco at the Current Theater. Michael, so glad to have you
on
the show.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
It was kind of fun getting to know you a little bit, even the misinformation I got via the internet, where everything's true. Preparing for our talk today. But I have to admit, I've only seen one episode of Ugly Betty.
Okay. Do you remember which one it was?
I don't.
I
can't even help you there. But it was neat seeing some clips of you and of the production that you got involved with How to Succeed in Business Without Really Trying.
Oh, yeah.
Because that was the first show that I, as a high school kid, we used to do a summer musical in Vernon, Connecticut. So that was the first show I played in the little pit for and just instantly hooked on Broadway.
It is one of the best musicals, I think, ever. It was already my favorite musical. And, you know, a testament to the great Frank Lesser, who wrote that score. When I joined that show, it had already been running for nearly a year. And the cast, who'd been in it for so long, we're still humming the music backstage.
It's pretty amazing stuff.
You know, some shows you get off stage and you don't even want to listen to what's going on stage, but that show, people were still loving.
And not a sloppy cast. Beau Bridges as the boss. Wow.
Yeah, it was fun.
How many productions did you do of that time?
I was in it for 5 months.
Wow, excellent.
Nick and I started together. Nick Jonas and I started together. Beau had been in it like a week or two before us, and we did it for about 5 months. It was a big hit. You know, before we'd done it, Daniel Radcliffe and John Larroquette had been doing it.
Right.
It was a real dream come true for me. It's a part I always wanted to play in a show I'd always wanted to do.
And a Broadway debut for
Yeah, that was my Broadway debut, singing, dancing.
Fantastic.
It was great.
So, yeah, I mean, you've done TV, you've done a lot of onstage theater, now Broadway. Is there a preference for you? Do you want to go straight, so to speak, in air quotes, drama or musicals or film? Or
you know, they all have their different... They're different, I would say, pros. I mean, of course, there are cons to everything, too. But, like, they're wonderful for different reasons. I mean, doing a Broadway musical is just about the most fun I've ever had. Truly. I mean, you know, of course, doing this one-man show for so long, there's so many benefits, and I get to, you know, I get all the glory, you know, at the end of the night. I'm the only one who gets to bow, and of course, it's such a fabulous part, and I've gotten to do it so much, but, you know, it can be isolating and lonely, and doing a Broadway show, I mean, there are dancers and singers and orchestra.
I'm just looking at the choreography in this production of How to Succeed. That must have been taken forever to learn some of those
moves. That was the hardest part for me, because I don't dance, and so that was really, really, so they had an amazing dance dancing. The dance captain taught me how to do it all. She's brilliant, and you know, it was like a birthday cake. The whole way through, it was just wonderful.
Well, next time you're on Broadway, we'll have you back on.
Somehow. Oh, good. I hope so. Yeah.
So let's establish the premise and the inspiration behind Jonathan Tollin's play Buyer and Seller, and that's okay. Seller, yes. C-E-L-L-A-R.
Right. So basically, Barbra Streisand, who we all know and love, built this big, beautiful home in Malibu. And in it, she created a place for her collectibles, her antiques and her old costumes that she'd kept, her enormous doll collection. And instead of just storage, or instead of just like, you know, a big antique room or whatever you might have, she built a street of shops, little fake shops in her basement. She basically built a mall in her basement. So John Tollins, this is all true, by the way. So John Tollins heard about this, saw the book, saw the photos from the book, and, off the cuff at a party said, how'd you like to be the guy who works down there? And the rest is kind of history. So John created...
The light bulb goes off. Yeah, yeah, let's...
Yeah, kind of.
I mean, got a show there.
It kind of was. Yeah, kind of did. That is sort of how it came about. So he thought he created this imaginary guy. He created a struggling actor in Los Angeles who has experience from working at Disneyland as a performer, but also as in one of the retail shops at Disneyland. So he knows the importance of artificial environments and the importance of running a shop. And this guy gets hired to run Barbara's shops in the mall. And he has one customer. And that's basically the show. She comes down and she stops in her own little mall. But so that's the premise. And you can probably imagine that's it's pretty funny what happens.
And you play multiple characters.
And I play everybody. Yeah, okay. I play them all.
But there's no drag or impersonation of Barbra going on.
That's right. That's right.
It's maybe a subtle gesture.
Yeah, it's sort of I just be her, and the audience has to fill in the rest. So what we sort of have realized is that the audience kind of plays a part, not only because it's a one-man show and it's a comedy and I'm talking to them, and so they have to, you know, they help me and they dictate how I do the show every night. I mean, it's the same words every night, but it's a little bit different because the audience is different. And so they're really, really important, but also because I don't change my clothes. I change my voice and mannerisms a little bit, but I take you on this like journey through these shops with just the same costume, the same me, and the same set. And the audience really has to fill in all the rest of it. They have to use their imagination. And I think that is part of why it's been successful, is because the audience really is, they walk away feeling like they've done the show too. Granted, I'm more tired, but I think it's really a community experience. You know, we're so used to movies and TV where there's nothing left to the imagination, and even on Broadway sometimes, even in shows sometimes, there's nothing left. You see helicopters flying in, you see chandeliers falling, you see cars driving on stage.
But it's all very tight.
Yeah. Yeah. And this you really have to imagine what I'm talking about. You really have to, you know, go back to it's almost like reading a book or listening to an audio book.
So has Barbra seen the show, or more importantly, has her lawyers vetted the show?
Yeah, her people have been, her people have been. She has not been. It would be weird if she came. I think you know, like I as much as I would love to meet her and be invited to the shops, I don't think it would really. I mean, certainly if I knew she was in the audience, it would be very challenging for me to do the show. And if anyone in the audience knew she was in the audience, that would be weird too.
Right.
But also, I just think it would be, you know, it's not a real story. We do have fun at her expense.
And let's be clear, it's an affectionate portrait. It's not a mommy dearest or anything.
No, absolutely not. And it's not a joke. I mean, yeah, there are a lot of jokes in it, but it's not like, it's not an SNL sketch or a drag act. It's really a play. And it just happens to be done by one person, and it happens to have a historical figure in one of the one of the characters. But it is, you know, I think she comes off great. You know, I think a lot of people say that they like her more after they see the play, and I feel a great affection for her, even though I don't know her.
Have you been a fan for a long time?
Or? I have. Yeah. I mean, not a huge fan. I'm more of a fan now than I ever was. But when I was 14, my mom and I watched her big comeback concert, her 94 comeback concert, and on PBS or something like that. And I thought she was brilliant. And my mom, I remember vividly my mom being like, this is what this means. And I was like, why is she making a joke about that? Why is she so nervous? And what does all this stuff mean? And my mom sort of taught me how to be a fan. And she's, you know, she's a wonderful talent. and you know, also a source of great levity.
That's great. Now, let's see. Is there a difference in your life professionally pre and post Ugly Betty? I mean, could this character actually have been you? In other words, if certain breaks hadn't happened.
Oh, sure.
In LA.
You know, I always think of actors as like snowflakes. Every actor's career is completely different.
And we'll melt down at some point.
We're constantly falling and we will probably melt away. but like, you know, like everything, of course.
That reminds me of the five stages of an actor's life.
Yes.
Who's Michael Urie? Michael Urie. You can't afford Michael Urie. Get me someone like Michael Urie. Who is Michael Urie?
Oh, that's good. I never heard you can't afford Michael Urie. I hear the get me Michael Urie, get me the next Michael Urie.
Right.
Who is Michael Urie?
That makes sense. Yeah.
And I felt all those things. But you go through those stages. I mean, hopefully, if your career is good enough, you go through those stages over and over again. Unfortunately, but also, you know, that's good. You know, that's the biz, you know, like you have your highs and lows certainly like I'd worked before Ugly Betty, but, that nothing even remotely, to the scope, of that. And it definitely completely changed the direction of my career. I think for the better. Who knows what would have happened to me otherwise? You know, I might have gotten another TV show, or I might have, you know, I mean, who knows? Who knows? It's crazy. Byron Seller has become this another exciting benchmark in my career. You know. And now when it's over, hopefully I'll have another one. And
speaking of that, I mean, you had about a year in New York. You just did a run in LA. Now you're in SF. Where does the show go from here?
Well, after this, we're going to go to Dallas, and that'll be the end of the national tour with me. It's going to play in Toronto with another actor, and then it'll play all over the place. And then there may be some more things. I don't think that Dallas will be the end of the road for me. I think I'll do it again. But I'm up to like 465 performances
something
crazy like that. I know. Can you imagine?
Golly, I can't. I really can't.
And it ain't short. It's 100 minutes.
Oh my God.
Of just me yapping. And it's crazy. I honestly can't get my head around it that I've been doing it. Not only I've done it so many times, but then I've now been doing it for so long through two birthdays. It's kind of crazy.
It's Michael Urie starring as the sole star, Buyer and Seller, CELLAR, Buyer and Seller. It's at the Curran Theater through the 31st. Information at shnsf.com or at buyerandseller.com. Michael, thanks so much for coming.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Scattered pictures of the smiles we left behind. Smiles we gave to one another. For the way we were. Isn't that nice? Thank you. Thank you. That's lovely. Can it be that it was all so simple then? Or has time rewritten every line? If we had the chance to do it all again.
so much more about Barbra Streisand through the 31st at the Curran Theater with Michael Urie and Buyer and Seller. That's music of Maurice Durufle from his Requiem, one of the works on a double bill of the San Francisco Lyric Chorus this weekend, Joseph Jongen's Mass completing the bill. The president of that organization joins me today in studio. Helene Whitson is a highly regarded librarian and archivist, documenting and writing about such events as the 1968 San Francisco State University strike and the history of television in the Bay Area, among other topics. Now in retirement, she's decided to devote herself to her passion, music, in particular choral music, and with her husband William and sister Valerie Howard, she co-founded the San Francisco Bay Area Choral Archive, an organization that documents choral life here in the greater Bay Area. No stranger to these airwaves, Helene has appeared several times on Voice Box, our late great vocal program that was hosted by Chloe Veldman. Helene, welcome back to KALW and the daytime hours of open air.
Thank you, David. It's great to be back here.
Well, Robert Gurney is conducting this program this Saturday at 7, this Sunday at 5, more Mission Dolores Basilica of these two major, major works, the
yes.
Durufle Requiem, more familiar to some than others, and the lesser-known Joseph Jongen's Mass. Tell us how you first came across Jongen.
Interestingly, we hosted a workshop, the chorus hosted a workshop in 2003 with John Poole, who is an emeritus director of the BBC Singers, the professional chorus for the BBC. And it was a week-long workshop, and John always brings things that you've never seen before because he likes to introduce you to things. So he brought the Jongen, and that's how we found it.
Very nice. And had you heard it before?
Oh, no.
No. I think it was discovered in only in 1985.
Yeah, by a Belgian group, and Jongen is Belgian, and the Brussels Choral Society premiered that work. So their conductor was rooting through an archive, firm believer in that, rooting through an archive and found the manuscript. And the music was only published in 1990.
Wow. So the genesis of Jongen creating this work has quite a history in itself, in the shadow of World War II.
Yes, absolutely. It was composed between in 1945. In 1943, one of his dear brothers died, so he was sad. In April of 1944, he found that his son had been arrested by the Gestapo and sent to Buchenwald, and he stopped composing. He had a friend who kept encouraging him and needed a mass for a particular anniversary of religious festival. In March of 1945, he found that his son was in Weimar, had somehow been released from Buchenwald and was being liberated by the Americans, and he could compose again. So that's where the mass comes from.
Wow, it's fascinating. And Jongen composing in Belgium.
Yes.
Durufle next door in France, also around the same time, within a year of each other, these works were written.
Yes.
But talk about contrasting.
Yes, they're different. It's hard with the borders to know where there are differences, but yeah, there's a different feeling to the Durufle. Durufle only composed 13 works in his life, anyhow, all religiously anchored and a lot based on chant. The Jongen brings much more modern textures. It's a combination, somebody said, one writer said, combination of neoclassical and modern. So you're going to hear classical patterns and classical tonality, and then you're going to hear these crunchy chords. It's this very, very different kind of piece.
Well, we opened with the Sanctus from the Durafle Requiem, but let's hear now the Sanctus setting that Jongen does.
A little bit different.
And then more with Helene Whitson. Canonic version further into the Sanctus
yes.
there. Wow, that is something. Now, this is one of two versions of the Mass that Jongen wrote,
yeah.
I understand. You guys are doing the version with just the chorus and orchestra.
Yeah, so here, the only recordings that I have found have the brass on it. And brass is wonderful. We love it. They lead parades and whatever. But if you really want to hear the interweaving with the inner parts, I think you'll get more of a sense of the piece with the organ and the chorus. You can hear a lot more of the inner workings, too. So it's more...
And also just wonderful writing for organ.
Oh, absolutely.
As similar to the Durafle.
Both of them were fine organists and composers. They're known for their organ works, both of them.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the San Francisco Lyric Chorus itself. How long have you been involved with the ensemble?
Robert and I co-founded it, so in 1995.
20th anniversary coming up next year. Plans must be well underway for that.
Yes. We have, in the next spring, we'll be doing some works we haven't chosen yet from the past 20 years. There's some good stuff in there, so we'll be repeating. And then we have a big celebration in the summer. We'll be performing at Mission Dolores because it's the 100th anniversary of the Basilica. And then we also will be celebrating the Panama Pacific International Exposition.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah.
So how does one get involved with the San Francisco Lyric Chorus? And if one wanted to be a part of the 20th anniversary season as a singer, how would...
Oh, come join us. We certainly have our web page at www.sflc.org. And we are recruiting in the fall. We don't like to be typecast, so going from Durafle and Jongen to Marc-Antoine Charpentier, that's French Baroque, plus some other things. So just check us out. There's a How to Join section right on our webpage.
Nice. SFLC.org. Now, you mentioned that the Jongen wasn't discovered until 1985 or something, or published until...
It was published in 1990. It was performed a little bit in the 40s in manuscript form.
Oh, I see.
And then the conductor of the Brussels Choral Society, Tom Cunningham, was probably rooting around in an archive, which I, of course, approve of, and found the manuscript and worked on it. And John Poole always has his eyes and ears open, so he's looking for those kinds of discoveries.
Well, you also have a special affinity for finding more obscure vocal works.
We do.
This wasn't one of your discoveries, though.
No, well, John was, so through John,
oh, there
yes.
You go. Have you brought some of these discoveries to the San Francisco Lyric Chorus? You said, hey,
yes.
Robert, have a look at this.
Yes, actually, we do. We don't like to be typecast. We do classical choral music. We've done Hildegard von Bingen. We've done Eric Whitaker, so we'll do everything from medieval to contemporary. But, for example, we did John Blow's 1684 St. Cecilia's Ode, Begin the Song. There is no recording of that I know. And probably our biggest work is Amy Beach's Grand Mass in E-flat major. That was a big work, and it's a magnificent piece of music. So there are things like that, sometimes little tiny ones, sometimes great big ones. We've done a lot of the works of Kirk Meacham, too, who's a friend of the chorus, so we're always happy to do works by Kirk.
Right. So you and Robert collaborate on what sort of repertoire is chosen?
Well, let's say I provide the smorgasbord, and he chooses, because with the Choral Archive, I'm always constantly listening and reading for old and new. You know, it's music. It's choral music. So I don't define my eras, but I often will be alerted to things that other people might not find. And I just say, bring out my table of things and say, here's the banquet you choose.
So we talked a bit about the Jungin. Why do you suppose Jungin isn't more widely performed or known?
I think it's just non-knowledge. It's just people don't know about it. I think when a work like this is discovered, people will do it. It's not an easy work. It's not where you can anticipate the choral patterns and say, oh yes, it's one of those, and your mind goes into automatic. You have to work at it, chord progressions, whatever, that sometimes a note will come out of nowhere. So it takes work. Mm-hmm. But I think when people discover it, it's a beautiful piece of music, and I'm hoping they'll bounce off of us. And
well, you'll have an opportunity to hear it this Saturday at 7 and this Sunday at 5, Mission Dolores Basilica. Information at sflc.org. The Jungin Mass. And now let's talk a bit about back to Du Roufle. Only published 13 works. It's
pieces.
Amazing.
Yeah.
And this has got to be his most glorious.
Yeah. Although in the fall, along with our Charpentier, we would be doing one of his four motets, the Ubi Caritas, which is probably the best known. So, yeah, he was critical. I think he might have written things. There are those people that write things and say, no way, and throw them away. But the only known things that we have are 13. Mm-hmm. He was an organist, too. So that can be, when you're a performer and a composer, you have competing things.
And again, interestingly, these were written within a year of each other, the Jungin and the Du Roufle.
Yes,
and
very different
works.
Yeah, and I'm not sure you can say they're country specific. They're just different. Sometimes you can pick out a style from a different, a particular country, but no, just very different.
And the Jungin being written as almost a celebration of knowing that his son was liberated from the camp.
Yeah.
And Du Roufle, in contrast, written as a memorial to his father.
But the Jungin, or the Du Roufle, ends, of course, with the In Paradisum, which is just so peaceful and so quiet. But the Agnus Dei, too, is quiet, but still has a kind of a lilting celebratoriness to it. So there's joy in the quietness.
Well, you mentioned In Paradisium. All of the movements of the Du Roufle are based on the Gregorian chant.
Yes.
And we're going to go out with In Paradisium from Du Roufle.
Oh, yes.
Not before I thank you for coming in today, Helene. And I wish you
so
a wonderful second career with the San Francisco Choral Lyric Chorus, San Francisco Lyric Chorus. Again, the concerts are Saturday at 7, Sunday at 5, Mission Dolores Basilica. Robert Gurney conducting the San Francisco Lyric Chorus. Jonathan Dimmock on the organ. Soloists include Alessandra Cameron, soprano, and Kevin Baum, baritone. Terrific concert. Information for the concert at sflc.org. Thanks again for coming in, Helen.
Thank you, David.
From the Du Roufle Requiem, here is In Paradisium.
Thank you.
the sublime Durafley in Paradisium, final movement of the Durafley Requiem. We heard the voices of Ascension Chorus and Orchestra under the direction of Dennis Keene. Robert Gurney leading the forces of the San Francisco Lyric Chorus this Saturday and Sunday. Once again, information at sflc.org. David LaTulipe now with Peter Robinson, who returns with a couple of reviews and a tribute to Lauren Bacall. Welcome back, Peter.
Hi, David. Good to be here. And my first review relates to Pygmalion, which opens with a strange contrast to that beautiful Gregorian chant. We have the cacophonies and screeches of a Cockney flower seller, Eliza Doolittle. Now, this is a very, very lively production, very engaging. And sometimes you have to remind yourself it was written in 1911 and 1912. So this satirical critique of class, gender, and snobbery in Victorian England in a strange sort of way rings true today. Many people may know the play Pygmalion through the musical My Fair Lady, and although the My Fair Lady stays within the realms of the story, this is the authentic, original My Fair Lady, Eliza Doolittle.
I'm wondering if you or other folks that are so familiar with both works are just expecting the actors to burst out into song when you see the original show.
Well, that's a very good question, because I did ask Professor Higgins in this production, played by Anthony Fusco, was he influenced by either Rex Harrison, who of course is I'm Just an Ordinary Man, and also by Leslie Howard, who actually in the 1939 movie of Pygmalion did play Professor Higgins. But I think this set has a set all of its own. The set itself is beautifully Victorian. It's actually Edwardian, to be precise. I highly recommend, if you're going out to Cowshakes at Arinda, arrive early, bring a picnic, and enjoy the pre-theatre talk by Philippa Kelly. She's a dramaturge, and this gives you plenty of extra insights to what I've already said is an engaging production.
Anthony Fusco is Henry Higgins, and Irene Lucio is Eliza Doolittle. Information about Pygmalion at calshakes.org.
And this runs until Sunday, August the 24th. That is the final performance. It's a play about transformation. It's a play not just about feminism. It's a play about finding yourself. And I think some of the ambiguity of the ending, which Jonathan Moscone has brought to this, I think will leave the audience thinking about it as they wander out. And I heard a few people saying after me, "How do you do?" Which, of course, comes from the garden party where Eliza is trained to speak the way an upper-class debutante would in Victorian and Edwardian England. And I even heard one say, "Not bloody likely." And, of course, that reminds me of the father of Eliza, who I think really does do a great performance. That's James Carpenter. He plays the dustman, Alfred, and it captures really both the toughness and the gentility of a father who's watching his daughter be transformed. So if you're looking for a lively, engaging piece of satire, a comedy with a serious purpose, I would highly recommend a Sunday afternoon production of Pygmalion. It's over at Cowshakes. You can get the train. There's a shuttle which takes you there from the train station straight up to the production. Pack a picnic. Enjoy the Grove in the early afternoon. The matinee is the production I always recommend. And do not miss Philippa Kelly's great introduction to this wonderful performance of Pygmalion.
Once again, calshakes.org for more information on that.
Well, we now change our scene to the world of movies, and in fact we're moving to the west coast of Ireland. We're moving to the area which is known as Sligo, and this movie has a specific title to it, a one-word title, Calvary. And once again, I think you've got to read it into two contexts. One is the current state of the Irish Catholic Church under scrutiny at the moment. And then secondly, as a reflection, a black comedy on what does spirituality mean, maybe what does religion mean in the 21st century. The play is both written and directed by John Michael McDonough, and at the heart of the play, the key character, a priest, Father James, who turns in a wonderful performance by Brendan Gleeson, has a highly dysfunctional parish on his hands. The play, in fact, begins in the confessional, and in the confessional, the priest is given one very, very disconcerting piece of information. The information is that he will be murdered within the next 7 days. So it's a kind of religious whodunit. And throughout the play, or I call it a play, but it is really, as I say, a movie, you are mystified as to who is the future killer, if the priest is to be killed, of the priest. And so for the next 7 days, as the story evolves, they put Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday. And finally, we get to the day of Sunday. Once again, it's a landscape movie. Sligo is that beautiful part of Ireland. You have the white waves breaking on the black rock symbolically. You've got characters who are adulterers. You've got characters who are financial greed. You've got characters who are coke addicts. And the priest himself is a recovering alcoholic.
Oh, so it's a family picture.
It's a family picture.
That's lovely.
That's right. And
it is rated R, by the way.
You want to be careful which parts of the family you take to it. The script is absolutely wonderful. There are some great one-liners in it. Listen up, since that Irish droll will kindly lull you into a very surprised piece of satire.
It's playing at a number of theaters here in the Bay Area. You can see a trailer and learn more about the movie itself by going to calvary-movie.com.
And I think because it is Sligo, there is one line from a W.B. Yeats poem, which often used Sligo, which kept coming back to me. And the line is, a terrible beauty is born. The priest is a good priest, but what he stands against is a dysfunctional community and a church which today is in current and major spiritual disarray. You'll enjoy the movie. See it, Calvary.
On the movie front, we lost a legend this past week, Peter.
Yes, indeed. And the legend, of course, is Lauren Bacall. And I really think for people like me, she was that Hollywood icon who really said everything. And I think she said it for three reasons. I think first and foremost, the look. And she had the look. She had the style. Secondly, she had the voice. And I think sultry alone doesn't just sum it up. There's a sort of sexiness, a firmness, a grittiness, a reality. And then, of course, she had the man. And, of course, the man was Humphrey Bogart. And from the earliest movies, they seem to have clicked. So you're actually catching in those black and white movies romance happening on the screen and happening in reality. Bogey was her man. They played opposite each other. And when he died, which was really an extremely sad moment in her life, she then went on to have a fling with Frank Sinatra.
And this was back in 1957 when Bogey died. It's hard to believe she lived so much longer after his
absolutely.
Passing.
And she said of Frank, yeah, I wish he'd shut up and just sing. So I bring that up because she was not a woman who in any way curbed what she thought. Some people may remember her for her legs. These, of course, appeared below the top of a piano when Harry Truman was president. And in every sense, she was a liberal. She believed in open-mindedness, and this ran through the entire life. She would go on to make over 40 movies. She won numerous awards, both on stage and on screen, obviously. And the one time I did hear her speak was in 2007. She was in London. She actually did the funeral address for Arthur Schlesinger at the Reform Club. And when I speak about the voice, that sultry voice carried in real life just as it did on the screen, she will be missed. She brought black and white movies to, I want to say, full technicolor. A great loss, but someone who's always there for us, recorded in film.
Thank you for that remembrance, Peter. And speaking of that voice, let's hear a little bit of that voice. We'll see you again soon, Peter. Lauren Bacall, the one and only from Applause.
Good to be here, David.
Welcome to the theater, to the magic, to the fun, where painted trees and flowers grow and laughter rings fortissimo and treachery sweetly done. Now you've entered the asylum, this profession unique. Actors are children playing hide and ego seek. So welcome, Miss Eve Harrington, to this business we call show. You're on your way to wealth and fame. Unsheathe your claws, enjoy the game. You'll be a bitch, but they'll know your name. From New York to Kokomo, welcome to the theater, my dear. You'll love it so.
The one and only Lauren Bacall from Applause, the Broadway production. We'll miss you, Lauren. Here's looking at you, kid. Here's looking at the end of Open Air for another week here on KALW. Open Air is produced by Neil Swinkles. Our shows are archived at kalw.org. I'm your host, David Latulipe, and if you have a segment suggestion for a future edition of Open Air, drop me an email, why don't you? David@kalw.org. Thanks for listening.
People.